AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair.
It's such an honor to present this next award.
And here are the nominees.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
And I can't deny the fact that you like me right now. You like me.
I'm the king of the world.
There's a mistake. Moonlight, you guys won Best Picture.
I'm Katie Rich, the deputy editor of VanityFair.com, and we're here recording earlier than usual with two people on the West Coast. So thank you in advance to everyone. In Los Angeles, we have our chief critic, Richard Lawson.
Hello.
In other parts of California, we have our senior writer, Joanna Robinson.
Actually, y'all, I'm in Austin, Texas.
Oh my God, you are. You're in a whole different time zone. Jesus. And holding down the fort in New York City, we have our digital director, Mike Hogan.
Hey.
So we're here gathered early and releasing early this week because we're doing a special Emmys episode. We all watched the Emmy Awards last night. I think as awards show junkies, we all surely enjoyed ourselves while also being truly horrified by the Masked Singer characters that kept showing up on stage. We'll talk about the telecast and you know how it worked as an award show as well. But I feel like this is a much more exciting Emmys than usual. And I would chalk it all up to Fleabag. Like that is by far the biggest story of the night, right?
Yeah, I feel like the Emmys are increasingly the hardest award show to predict just because, I don't know, like I think that the more offerings there are in TV, you know, you can't really zero in on any one show. And I think you're right, Katie, Fleabag was, you know, I thought it was going to win a writing award and maybe something else, but like it won so many things and in so doing denied Veep the victory lap that everyone assumed it was going to get.
Yeah.
And Julia Louis-Dreyfus.
Yeah. Veep getting shut out is one of the craziest things I've ever seen at the Emmys. Like, I'm so delighted for Phoebe Waller-Bridge and all the Fleabag wins. I think it's great, but Veep not getting a single thing when they did, you know, an onstage ceremonial farewell for them is sort of stunning, so...
Yeah, I mean, this is the same Television Academy that gave Modern Family like five Emmys in a row this decade. Like the Emmys track record for rewarding the same thing over and over again is so established that I don't think anyone thought they would break out of that pattern for this.
Well, and I think when you saw Tony Shalhoub win an Emmy, you thought, oh, okay, the Emmys are up to their old thing. They just like, you know, there's like six people that they whose names they recognize and they keep giving them the Emmy. And so yeah. That would have suggested that Julia Louis-Dreyfus was going to win. And it really, really didn't turn out that way. It's really interesting. Like, did they hate the season or were they just kind of like, you've got enough Emmys, you don't need any more? Or it seems like they all flipped for Fleabag, but it seems like also, I mean, Joe Reed was pointing out, like, where was all this last year? This is season two of Fleabag. You know, you didn't have a sense coming in that like, wow, they loved it so much last year. I guess maybe they started watching it this year. It was really, as you said at one point last night, Katie, all over the place.
Well, I think Fleabag is definitely a show that has grown in its second season from word of mouth. I think I know a lot of people who watched both seasons in one sort of go because you can, because it's a quick watch. And so I think, yeah, season one didn't land the way that season two did. Thank you, Andrew Scott. And, you know, so, I think it was a bigger hitter this year. I think, you know, Katie and I have been talking about this a little bit off podcast, but I think you can't underestimate the money involved that, like, Amazon's pockets versus HBO's pockets, however deep HBO's pockets may be, might have won the day here.
But did you see, I think of Netflix campaigning like crazy. Have you seen lots and lots and lots of expensive Amazon campaign work? Because I'm not sure that I have.
Katie was just looking into this. There was this Maisel Day that they did that, you know, jammed up traffic in Los Angeles. And then they did this pop-up guinea pig cafe thing for Fleabag. So yeah. I think, I don't know if dollar for dollar they match Netflix, though I imagine they might. But I think two things are in their favor, which is focus. Netflix backed a bunch of different comedies, right? It did like Russian Doll, Glow, Kaminsky Method, Grace and Frankie all kind of got equal attention from them, whereas Amazon narrowed in on Fleabag and Maisel in a way that and tailored those FYC campaigns sort of specifically to the personalities of those shows versus Netflix. They book these huge Raleigh studios in Hollywood. They've got these displays for all their shows, but it's not sort of like quirky, standout-y kind of spending the way that Amazon went for this year.
Right. And when you think about Amazon's batting average for awards versus Netflix, it's like you wouldn't want to be looking at those numbers today in the Netflix offices.
Well, yeah, and that's the whole like Netflix model is like they want to flood the zone with all of the content you can possibly have. They release a new movie every week. They release a new show. And with movies, I think they've been able to really carefully decide like which ones get a theatrical release, which ones they'll put a campaign behind. So, you know, they're not trying to like get an Oscar for the Adam Sandler movies. But for television, that whole effort really forces them to spread what they're able to do. And I wonder if they're going to have to reconsider that because they're going up against literally the richest man on the planet to spend money on these FYC campaigns. So how do you compete?
Yeah, and we should also say that, you know, technically, HBO won the most awards, Netflix won the second most awards, and Amazon won the third most awards when you count the Creative Arts Emmys, which we should. But the narrative of the night definitely belonged to Amazon because all those Fleabag wins felt so unexpected and exciting and the momentum. And so, like, despite the fact that the numbers actually back HBO and Netflix, I mean, this felt like an Amazon win narratively.
We should keep it in mind, but I feel like there are two different things to me. The total number of Emmys and the Emmys that actually get given out in the broadcast are, you know, they're sort of two different contests in a way.
Right, but HBO still got the most number, technically the most number of Emmys on Sunday night. It just doesn't feel that way.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, I went to both the HBO and Netflix parties here in LA last night. I was going to go to the Amazon one, but for various reasons, you know, I didn't. But, you know, the HBO party was this huge event at the Pacific Design Center, kind of out on this plaza, and it was different tiers and all these. There was a grooming station and a makeup booth and it was a pretty lavish party, let's say. And I turned to a friend who I was there with and I said, this feels like the party where they thought they were winning both big top prizes. Mm-hmm. And then the Netflix party, while lively, was in a huge space that was only maybe half filled. And that also felt like, even though you saw Jason Bateman walking around with his Emmy or Julia Garner, both from Ozark, with her Emmy, I did talk to people there who were like, wait, but what did they win? You know, like the profile of their night was not clear, even at their own party. And whereas I feel like at the Amazon one, it probably almost assuredly, you know, they had a narrative that you could really like be excited about being, you know, present for.
Well, and Joanna, as you're writing right now about kind of how it was a big night for streamers as expected, and the landscape is going to be so different next year, like not just because Disney Plus and Apple TV Plus are going to be out there, but like Netflix is going to have The Crown next year. Like HBO isn't going to have Game of Thrones. Like there's so much flux from year to year. Fleabag is never going to win another Emmy, which is like right. One of the many things that makes it such an unusual winner. Like especially comedy categories, you get the same winner year after year after year. This is such an unusual winner there, and it will be really interesting to see who jumps in now that Fleabag and Veep out of the competition.
I mean, that might be another reason why Fleabag won, right? It's like their only chance to not goof up and honor this show that everyone likes so much. You know what I mean? Like, it was their last chance to honor Veep, but they had already honored Veep so much. So this is their only chance because there's going to be no more Fleabag. And that narrative is interesting too to me because Hulu was the belle of the ball just a couple years ago with Handmaid's Tale, and Handmaid's Tale was only like partially eligible this year. But the idea that if all your wins come from one show, that can be a really precarious place to sit. But HBO had a pretty wide spread in terms of, you know, they have Last Week with John Oliver, they've got Succession, you know, something else that I'm forgetting, and Thrones.
Chernobyl,
and Thrones. So they had the widest spread of shows bringing them in trophies, and I think that's good news for their future, even if Thrones is going away.
Can I use Chernobyl to pivot to Thomas Lennon for a second? The most controversial element of the Emmys broadcast, I think. So he's a comedian. He was doing kind of the talking over people as they walk up to the stage with jokes that I mostly found funny. And then I think half of my Twitter feed wanted to burn him alive. Where did we all land on this?
I liked it. I thought it was lively in a show that otherwise wasn't. You know, I think the Oscars last year or earlier this year squeaked by without a host in a way that we were like, oh, that was interesting. But I think the Emmys last night really suffered from not having a kind of unifying sense of humor. Mm-hmm. And I thought that Thomas Lennon, in whatever weird way, and maybe not everything was perfectly synced, like, timing-wise to, like, when people were walking on the stage. Like, it felt a little bit like out of nowhere this voice suddenly arrived. But I thought, I don't know, I was amused, you know. I thought it was fine. You know, I think it was certainly... it was something. It was a bit of a perspective beyond, like, hey, we're Fox and we're having wrestling and Masked Singer coming soon, so stay tuned, you know?
Yeah.
I thought it was perhaps a noble but failed experiment. I mean, he was funny, especially on Chernobyl, the line about Chernobyl was filmed, you know, in Studio City, California, in front of a live audience. And
that line made me laugh so hard. Yeah.
But also, like, I was watching with my wife and she was like, wait, what? Like, it didn't, I think it was like not necessarily, I think for a certain crowd of comedy, you know, insiders, it was funny. And then I'm guessing for a huge group of people, it was like, what the hell is going on here? I couldn't really hear it half the time. And I do feel like there's something a little bit rude. I don't know. It felt a little rude, maybe, but maybe I'm being an old stick in the mud of, like, at this moment when the person is exulting and coming down to sort of, like, make jokes that quasi make fun of them. I don't know. I think I would not. I hope they don't do it again.
Well, if they do it again, they could at least have someone like a host explain kind of at the top of the show. I know that the people in the theater were not going to hear this voice, or at least I don't think they were. Maybe they were.
Yeah.
But like, even so, just for the audience at home, like, it did just at first come out of nowhere. And you were like, is there like a weird another audio feed kind of mixing with Fox's broadcast?
Yeah,
I don't understand.
Right. I mean, right. Maybe you could do it again and lean into it more. The way it was, it did feel like somebody had just kind of like hacked into the audio rather than it was an actual part of the show.
Like that weird Max Headroom thing from Chicago from years ago when someone just broke into the feed. Yeah. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the reviews director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, Jay Paul, Muna, Jesse Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.
This message comes from Apple Card. Earn up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase, every day. Then, grow it at 4.50% annual percentage yield when you open a savings account with Apple Card. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card subject to credit approval. Savings available to Apple Card owners subject to eligibility. Savings accounts provided by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, member FDIC. Terms apply. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How is your social battery right now? What's the right amount of socializing for you? And how do you recharge? Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you need more alone time. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/littlegoldmen today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp. HELP.com/littlegoldmen.
Well, the element that I think we can all hope they'll bring back for the Oscars and everything else is the presence of thingamajig on stage. Richard, I convinced you to write an entire piece about this somehow.
Yeah,
that was so weird.
I sat in a hotel room in West Hollywood while a bunch of fabulously speedoed pool goers, you know, beneath me, you know, hung out by the pool, and I wrote about
the standard.
It was quite an experience. Yeah, I mean, that was something that I found both depressing in that this is the Fox Broadcasting Company, which is still retained by Rupert Murdoch as part of the Fox News kind of profile, or portfolio rather, where he's, you know, he got rid of 20th Century Fox, the film division and the television producing division. So this network, they're calling it kind of New Fox, is going to be a different thing. And it's going to be largely focused, from what I'm told, on reality programming and live sports, which are, you know, very lucrative and easy to... Well, at least in reality sense, easy to produce and not too expensive. Sports rights cost a zillion dollars. But you know, this was their first chance to really advertise that. And it just was so interesting how it offset, you know, things like Fleabag winning and Chernobyl and all these, you know, really respectable, high-minded things. And then in between those wins, they were like, here's thingamajig to, like, remind you about this shit. You know, like, it just felt very honest in a way that I kind of appreciated. It was like, yeah, this is the way that some broadcast television is heading because, the cable and streaming have been eating their lunch for years now. And or I guess, you know, certain broadcast shows still do very well. But, like, I don't know. It just felt like a weird glimpse of the future to me.
When was the last time a major broadcast show really won a big Emmy? Like, I'm looking back, like, Veep has been winning the category in comedy, and then Maisel since 2015. Like, drama has really belonged to cable for, like, a decade now. And we looked up the Fox nominations, Tally Richard. Like, they weren't nominated for a single show during the actual broadcast, which is part of what made it so surreal that they were airing it. It's like, here's old television telling you all about new television.
Yeah, and they had Glee in 24, you know, not that long ago. Like,
yeah.
They used to be in the mix for things, and some of their comedy. Certainly, you know, Arrested Development. But yeah, it was like, you know, This Is Us, I think, is one of the few things kind of keeping networks in the Emmys, The Good Place a little bit as well. But like, it just felt this kind of like complete, I mean, granted, also very Murdochian kind of in its shamelessness, like just concession to like, we're not you guys anymore. Like, we're this now. And yeah, we'll show your award show, but like, we're not, you know, that's a whole different thing. That's for a bunch of like, you know, coastal snobs. Here's the meat and potatoes for everyone else who I don't think was even watching the Emmys.
It reminded me of, you know, we excerpted back in July, a book, an oral history of the Trump rise called The Method to the Madness by Alan Salkin and Aaron Short. And it's so crazy and sort of darkly funny. They talk about the escalator announcement. And, you know, according to these people, at least, they were all very self-aware about the fact that it was going to be totally repulsive and disgusting to millions of Americans. And they were excited about it. And that kind of was the vibe that I got off the Masked Singer thing. It was Fox just being like, oh, my God, I can't believe they gave us the keys to this thing for one night. Let's just be as disgustingly Fox as we can because no one can stop us. But I am looking forward to the reveal of Thingamajig because I understand it's Kieran Culkin and Lachlan Murdoch together inside the suit.
The rare double Masked Singer.
One of the other like weird show elements of this to me was the Game of Thrones tribute and then later the Veep tribute that kind of broke up halfway through the middle of the show. And Joanne, I was talking to you during it about how just like incredibly awkward it felt to like eulogize Game of Thrones, especially because Bran, Isaac Hempstead, right, was not on stage, even though he won the Game of Thrones. Joanne, how did that strike you?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how the that went over with you guys where you were watching, but it did not seem to go over super well in the room. I mean, okay, let me be fair. There was, I think, the first standing ovation of the night was for the Game of Thrones cast. It was really fun to see Gwendolyn Christie get the largest cheer of all from the crowd. But
she looked like visibly surprised by that too. It was really charming.
It was very sweet. And Emilia Clarke got a big cheer, we should say, as well. But you know, the setup for it itself just seemed a little off and odd. And, you know, the lines that they had to read about the show seemed a little stilted. So for viewing audiences at home, it seemed a little off kilter. And then especially when Thrones made kind of a, I mean, is it fair to say it was a muted showing when they won Best Drama? I think so, because they had an opportunity to win so many more awards last night and they didn't. So, you know, they picked up the expected prize for Dinklage. They picked up the top prize, which, you know, I don't know that I can argue with whatever my feelings were about the final season, given what it meant impact-wise to television. But, you know, they lost out in it's crazy to me that Peter Dinklage is still the only actor to ever win an Emmy for Game of Thrones. And yeah. 4 times, you know, so.
To me, it had the weird, like, ring of that it was less about celebrating the show for its artistic merits, which, you know, technically the Emmys are supposed to be doing, and more about, like, you made us so much money and now you're going, like thank you, like, please don't leave, you know, kind of thing. Like, it felt a little sweaty in that way. And Veep, to kind of Veep tribute to a lesser extent, you know, I'm sure the economics of that are pretty good too, but, like, you know, Game of Thrones was a global phenomenon unlike we've seen in a long time, and I it felt like they were sort of thanking their you know, king, you know, or something, who was retiring or something. It felt a little bit like kissing a ring. I don't know. It did sit strangely. And you know, again, to go back to the HBO party for all of Game of Thrones wins, like, it was not as celebratory a mood maybe as there could have been.
Well, and also, like, in the months since Game of Thrones went off the air, it feels like it's been off the air forever. Like, that last season was such kind of a mess creatively, and, like, the discourse just got so exhausting that, like, having, you almost feel like all of them coming back on stage, they're just like, oh, let it be over. Like, I want to move on with my life.
You're so right. I was just thinking that, actually. And I think that it's because the season wasn't good, you know? And I think people just got left with it really squandered so much enthusiasm and excitement. It's too bad. I think in the long run, we'll look back and admire the show, but I think there's a long hangover from it just being such a letdown.
I think there is a sour taste for a lot of us who covered it and who watched it. But I did hear from people who were on the show that they were all excited to see each other again. So I don't think that they themselves were like, ugh, can't believe we have to do this. You know, they were excited to go. They're, I'm sure, excited to have won the biggest, you know, Emmy of the night. That at least is not a full embarrassment for them. You know what I mean? At least, yeah, they, like, walked away with that. But I think I agree with you guys, for all of us, for me, who has talked about Game of Thrones almost nonstop for years, I have not wanted to talk about it much for the last few months because, you know, or even talk about entertaining ideas of this prequel series that they're doing, because I was just like, I need a break from Westeros, please. You know, which is why we can be so excited about something like Fleabag, because it just felt so fresh and different and new and exciting and deserving of all the awards it got. So that was my takeaway from the night, with the exception of maybe Game of Thrones winning the biggest prize. I feel like everything that was exciting felt deserved. Everything surprising felt deserved. And then there are a few rubber stampers like SNL, where I'm just like, ugh, all right, fine. You know, SNL had a terrible season last season, but it always wins this category, so fine. You know.
Well, and I know you stand Ozark, Joanna, so that's great.
Well, you know, I love Julia Garner. It's true. And, you know, Jason Bateman won, you know, I don't know if you guys have seen the slow-mo reaction of Jason Bateman winning, but it is a thing of beauty because he is like, I'm sorry.
It is a flawless reaction shot.
What? Laura Linney is like, what? In Tony is what Laura Linney is giving us. But you know, that was a result of 3 entries from Game of Thrones eating each other in that category, yeah. I have to think, you know. So, yeah. But I'm always on the lookout for that, Mike, since you raised this on the podcast a couple of years ago, that idea of, like, the double threat or the triple threat or the celebrity director or the celebrity writer. And it really does seem to shine through at the Emmys.
Yeah, I mean, Phoebe Waller-Bridge is such an irresistible figure for that, because she's, like, what she has made is so good. She's so charming. She's so interesting to talk to, and, like, to, like, look at her and be like, you just made this perfect thing. Like, you want to just throw Emmys at her.
Do we want to talk about the Michelle Williams speech?
Yeah, I was just wanted to ask what other victories that we felt like were, like, universally good. And I feel like Michelle Williams having an Emmy is something we can all get behind too.
Yeah, and I mean, yeah. I think she made really good use of her moment. Sorry, Richard, go ahead.
No, yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, obviously she didn't thank us, but I think the fact that we had her on the podcast is what got her the win, obviously. I feel very comfortable taking credit for that. But yeah, I think, like you said, Joanna, like, in a show that felt, you know, very sweet, good, you know, nice speeches, very happy, Michelle Williams came up there and actually did say something about, you know, pay inequity, especially for women of color compared to their white male colleagues. And it felt pertinent to the moment. And it also, I think, recognized that, like, something like When They See Us walked in that theater with 11 nominations and left with, I think, maybe one or two. I mean, and Jerrell Jerome won. But, like, you know, and I think that there was a sense of disparity in the broadcast last night. And even though Michelle Williams herself is, you know, a white woman who's been, you know, famous for a long time and was arguably one of the bigger kind of, quote, movie stars in the room, I think that it was great that she used that victory and that platform to sort of mention other people in the room, either, you know, kind of indirectly. It felt really good. I don't know. It felt kind of righteous. And I think the audience responded in kind.
And it also felt very it's both personal to Michelle Williams, right? Because as she mentioned backstage, there was this, you know, pay equity scandal around All the Money in the World where Mark Wahlberg got like $1.5 million and she got $1,000 or something like that to do
reshoots.
Something
really crazy. Yeah.
So, you know, that was a personal thing that she went through and experienced, but also topical to the piece of art she made, because this show was about Gwen Verdon, like, getting her moment in the spotlight after being, you know, sort of overshadowed by her creative partner, Bob Fosse. So, you know, it was a really good marriage of, it didn't feel sort of out of place. I will say that while I really, really appreciate what Patricia Arquette said, that one did feel slightly out of place, but, like, I'm not going to be mad at Patricia Arquette for stumping for trans rights on stage. Of course, that's great, but it's not, it didn't have the same organic flow that Michelle's speech did, you know?
Know that fizzy feeling you get when you read something really good, watch the movie everyone's been talking about, or catch the show the internet can't get over? At the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast, we chase that feeling 5 times a week. We talk about the buzziest movies, TV, music, books, and more. From lowbrow to highbrow to in between, catch the Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast from NPR.
Yeah, and there's, I mean, Billy Porter also kind of took advantage of his moment. I think the stat is that he is the first openly gay actor of color to win the Best Drama Emmy. I feel like there has to be, like, he might be the first openly gay actor of color to win any Emmy. I don't know the details. Anyway, it was like a build as a history-making moment, and I feel like he really kind of stepped up to that moment in his speech.
Yeah, and it was also, you know, Billy Porter winning is so interesting. The Fleabag wins are interesting. Like, and then you have on the other side of things like Maisel, you know, Alex Borstein winning again and Tony Shalhoub winning. And, you know, I felt like Tony Shalhoub won an Emmy every year for a decade for Monk, which actually he only won 3 or 4. But you know, there was a really interesting bifurcation between what you would kind of assume to be the traditional conservative, you know, we just, you know, hit the button for the name we recognize kind of voting. And then this other stuff that's really interesting. And I mean, I don't know that we'll ever know the answer to this question, but, like, is it just a different kind of part of the Academy that's voting for things like Billy Porter and, you know, Fleabag, or are those kind of impulses existing within individual members? I don't know. It's just, I thought that was so sort of fascinating to consider, you know, because Michelle Williams gave an exciting speech, but by some other sort of standards, she was a safe win. You know, she's an established movie star. She's, you know, been, you know, got her start in a big way on television. Like, it was she's a pretty familiar entity to vote for, and she's in a thing about showbiz. So, yeah, I'm very curious about what the kind of, you know, makeup of the Academy right now, not just in terms of actual membership, but in terms of, I don't know, ideology in a way, because last night felt very almost, you know, cut in two.
Mm-hmm.
It did feel like they were spreading the wealth a little bit, too. And I don't know how, I don't know if voters in the Academy would ever think that way, but it had the little bit of a vibe of that.
Yeah, when you see, like, Jerrell Jerome winning when They See Us didn't win anything else, you get the sense that, like, people like that show, they wanted to give it something, so they rallied around him, which was kind of hard to argue with. His speech was great.
I think that was my favorite moment, and I was so glad when, you know, the formerly known as Central Park Five, now known as the Exonerated Five, when they stood up and you just think, that, you know, thank God they got this moment. They came all the way there. But what an incredible moment of triumph for everybody involved in that project. And he just gave a terrific speech. So that was, to me, was the standout.
Yeah.
Something that we don't have the full shape of yet, and we may never, is this idea of how much block voting did or did not affect the Emmys this year. Block voting, you know, people voting in a sort of in a group in a quid pro quo fashion, is not supposed to be allowed at the Emmys, but of course is allowed at the Emmys. I was reading some reports about how on certain studio lots, they'll have banners being like, reminder, if you are a so-and-so employee, vote for this sort of thing. But there was,
what we do for the Webbies.
But there was a scandal earlier this year where some people in the acting branch, I believe it was, were sort of openly trying to engage in some block voting on a close Facebook group, and they got kicked out of being able to vote by the Television Academy. So the Television Academy was, quote unquote, cracking down on block voting, you know, making an example of these actors. And I don't know if that spooked the usual block voting crew, and perhaps that's why we got such like a interesting scattershot result this year. Like maybe that actually did work and people didn't engage in block voting. I don't know.
You think Julia Louis-Dreyfus's block voting cabal was disrupted?
maybe. I mean, I don't have, you know, Katie won't let me print this because I don't have concrete numbers to back it up, and I respect her as an editor for that, but I will.
But you can say it on a
podcast. Definitely just talk about it on a podcast. What could go wrong?
I'll just say it on a podcast. A couple outlets have included in their reports, and I don't have the concrete data, so take it with a grain of salt, but reputable outlets have reported that HBO has the biggest number of voters in the Television Academy. And so if that's the case, then I'm surprised they couldn't get their, you know, themselves together to vote for Veep.
So what happened, this is a kind of a Little Gold Men exclusive. So I had been running a thing where if I would Photoshop an actor into like a water polo team or something, and that's how I would get them the win.
Into USC, right? Like, yeah, they got a scholarship for the process.
Yes, but that, I got busted, so I couldn't do my usual thing. So that's why JLD didn't win.
Heard it here.
You got
first.
Paid well in the process, though.
Oh, I'm very rich.
I mean, when you talk about block voting, which like I admit I don't fully understand how it works, just because I don't understand like what it means for HBO to have voters. Like, is it people who have like been on Deadwood once, or is it like executives? But I also think, you know, this whole theory that everyone wants their show to be picked up by Netflix or Amazon, like that might be a new factor in this. Like, if those are the ones who are spending all the money and they can get you paid better for your pitch or whatever, like, why wouldn't you like try to, you know, give a boost to Mrs. Maisel or something like that? Everyone wants to be Phoebe Waller-Bridge.
I also wonder if Amazon weirdly benefits from the Netflix resentment just by virtue of being smaller and not sort of threatening to fully eat the rest of Hollywood. So it's kind
for
of
now.
I feel like people, certainly we see this in the Oscars, that people resent Netflix and we discuss it as a hurdle. And I wonder if in the TV world too, people are kind of like, am I really going to vote for the Netflix show? But that may create an opening for Amazon, which people don't think of as the same way. Amazon Prime is not the sort of number one threat to the old way of life or whatever.
I think it is interesting, Mike. Like, I think that's for sure, you know, a kind of anxiety out here. And yet you talk to other people, I won't name names, but like people I spoke to last night who are sort of more on the creative side of things, directors and whatnot, and they feel very sanguine about Netflix because Netflix is letting them do what they want to do. And, you know, but I'm sure on the sort of more business side of things and, you know, people who work for networks rather than work for a project, there is some timidity about like this great thing kind of consuming everything. So I think that like that's kind of speaks back to the Fox thing with the thingamajig. Like I really think we are in this crux point, especially on the, you know, eve of Disney Plus and all that. Like this is an industry and an academy that's really at this quaking point, and it's really grappling with itself. And I think that's maybe why we saw a sort of scattered mix of winners, because certain people are doubling down on the traditional like stuff, and other people are just trying to be more experimental and grow with the times. And I think we're going to see that for a few more years at least to come.
Well, your piece raises a really interesting question, which is, what is a broadcast network for? And it's probably for sports and other live events and reality shows, you know, and all this kind of stuff that we think of as prestige Emmy worthy content. It seems to be migrating to the platforms. So it's really interesting because, to make the broadcast economics work, you need a huge audience at the same time. And there aren't that many ways to do that these days.
And maybe if you're an Academy member who has, you know, worked at a network and, you know, HBO and one time Showtime and FX have been eating your awards lunch for years now, maybe you're just like, more like whatever about Netflix. Whereas if you're like someone who works at HBO and, you know, maybe you're less inclined to vote for a Netflix thing because it feels like a much fresher threat. I don't know. I mean, we're now just inferring psychology of people, but like,
well, No, I think you're right. And the last thing I'll say about HBO is there a Plepler AT&T effect here? You know, that was the other question I had is like, was there, you know, I've seen Richard Plepler work a room. You guys probably have too. He is, you know, he's like wrapping his arm around your neck and whispering in your ear. And he's a former PR guy. You know, he came out of the comms department. So I do think that there's a certain, you know, they probably feel a loss. And I do think there's a question in general about, like, where is HBO going in this new AT&T land? Are they really going to be the kind of big overachiever in the prestige award space, or are they going in a different direction?
There's also some behind the scenes changes both this year and next that we might want to mention. One is, I mean, they're both byproducts of peak TV, right? So one is this, I guess it's not new this year, but it's just ever growing, which is this overwhelm by Emmy voters of the sheer number of nominees that they have to comb through. You know, there's like the ballot they got this year had 108 candidates for comedy series, 165 candidates for drama series, and 107 candidates for variety special. And so trying to comb through all of that, maybe in the past, if you were a really goody two-shoes Emmy voters, you tried to watch everything, and now it's impossible. And so now maybe you just give up and vote for the things that either everyone's talking about, which is Fleabag, or the thing that everyone watched, which was Game of Thrones. And then another thing that's changing currently is because of peak TV, The FYC screeners are being phased out by the Television Academy. So next year, there's a full ban. They're no longer sending out physical screeners. They're only doing digital screeners. So this year, people started to send out digital screeners, a few people. Amazon and Netflix did not. But, you know, they're in the midst of phasing that out. And one thing that I thought was really interesting in a report I read is that if they send out digital screeners, people who run Emmy's campaigns can see which screeners Emmy voters are actually watching and tailor their campaigns to those shows. And apparently they already do that with TV critics monitoring which screeners we're watching. So, you know, it's just, you know, the digital age, and this is more info that they're getting to tailor to narrow and tailor their campaigns, which is good news for them, but bad news for maybe some of the smaller shows that maybe would have come through in an era when people could physically watch all of the things that were on offer.
I'm just glad they're the only digital media company that's monitoring what we watch. Like, that's no one else is doing that, right?
That's it.
Surely.
All right. Any final big winners you guys wanted to shout out or felt particularly excited about, or like moments that stood out for you?
Ben Whishaw.
Oh, yeah. Ben Whishaw. Yeah. He has an Emmy. Who would have guessed?
I was just happy to see something for that show, A Very English Scandal, which I liked. And a lot of people don't know it exists. So that's a good thing to watch. Four episodes.
Well, it was an interesting thing when he won, because, you know, when they announce the names of the nominees, like, you hear the audience at the theater, like, whoop it up, you know. He got, like, no whooping it up at all. And then won. Which was, like, a really interesting juxtaposition. But, yeah, I think that was such a strong show, and with two really great performances, him and Hugh Grant, that, again, with the spreading of the wealth, that was, like, you know, and one for you, Glenn Coco, very, like, you know, for that. Like, I thought that was good. I kind of like that. I mean, I think that maybe we were starved for a sort of unifying narrative last night, which makes it harder to write about them. So, you know, that's our sort of own selfish interest. But, like, yeah, it's great that someone like Ben Whishaw won. I also, you know, I know that it's not a new thing, but it was cool to see Drag Race win and be able to go up on stage and sort of talk about their show, and which has been such a phenomenon that has changed people's lives, either indirectly or directly, in a way that I think few reality shows have in a long time.
Oh, I think the narrative is Phoebe Waller-Bridge is a humongous hitter and is going to be inescapable for the next, like, 40 years. That's to me the narrative.
To all of our benefit.
Yeah.
Well, Jodie Comer's win is also kind of a Phoebe Waller-Bridge win, right?
Yeah.
Because Jodie Comer's character was, you know, adapted from the book by Phoebe Waller-Bridge. You know, she didn't write the second season. She helped create Villanelle. And Villanelle feels like a very Phoebe Waller-Bridge character. So, yeah, it's great stuff. I'm really excited.
And I tweeted about this too, but Phoebe Waller-Bridge was there with Martin McDonagh, who she's been dating for some time. And I was thinking about them as a power couple. And then the coming Oscar season with Noah Baumbach and Greta Gerwig will both have movies out there. So it's a great time if you are a big fan of very smart writers and creators being in relationships with each other.
the last shout out I want to give is to circle back to Billy Porter and mention what a number of people mentioned on Twitter last night, which is that he is now just an O shy from an EGOT.
Him and Lin-Manuel Miranda both, right?
Put Billy Porter on EGOT watch. Here he comes. Ben Whishaw is like, what, a G, an O, and a T shy. But like, I don't know. The T feels inevitable. The O feels possible. Let's look out for a Ben Whishaw album, and then we'll be all set.
Yeah, in the same way that it's weird Michelle Williams now has an Emmy, but not an Oscar, it's weird that Ben Whishaw has an Emmy, but not a Tony.
Yeah, it's very weird. He's got a Golden Globe. That's nice.
Hey. All right. Well, I mean, do we want to say like good Emmys? We feel like show all over the place, but maybe there's more excitement than not from this night.
I mean, I can't really say good or bad. I think that what they were was very reflective of right now, you know, where everyone's feeling a little scattershot, not really sure what kind of plot line to follow. And, you know, I think that like maybe Ozark winning awards was because, you know, Game of Thrones people were splitting the vote or whatever. But like that felt like a very concession to the dad shows. And then Maisel felt like a concession to something else and et cetera, down the line. So I think that maybe that is the maybe more democratic future that we're looking forward to with the Emmys. I will say, though, I do think it needs a host.
Mm-hmm. It'd be very interesting to see how the Oscars fare in the wake of this.
Yeah, I say bad show, good winners. That's what
fair.
I say.
Yeah,
yeah. I think the show was a hot mess with two T's in the word hot. but I think that yeah, it was a good spread of winners. I mean, I think you got the sense that they were actually like watching the shows and paying attention, which is not always the case at the Emmys in my experience.
Yeah. Well, next week we'll be back to talking about movies. It might be a little while before we deep dive into television again, although you can hear Joanna and Richard talk about television every week on Still Watching. There's a plug for you.
Emmy winner succession.
Yeah, exactly. You can find tons and tons of Emmy coverage on VF.com from all of us and our colleagues. So please go there and check it out. And you can find all of us on Twitter at Little Gold Men and on our own. I'm at Katie Rich. Richard?
Rylaws.
And Joanna?
Joe wrote this.
And Mike.
Mike_Hogan.
This week's episode was edited and produced by Brett Fuchs, and this week's award for the best description of what the critics will say when we add thingamajig to next week's Little Gold Men goes to Mike Hogan.
A noble but failed experiment.
I'm Chris Murphy.
I'm Richard Lawson.
And I'm Hilary Busis. We are from Vanity Fair's Still Watching podcast. Next up, we're watching the new HBO show, The Regime.
Madam Chancellor, let's keep the gloves on.
This is not a confrontation. We're just saying what's true.
Academy Award winner Kate Winslet is our chancellor as she leads a faux European autocracy in turmoil.
We'll be watching week by week as The Regime unravels.
And we'll be talking to the stars along the way.
New episodes of Still Watching will drop every Sunday after The Regime airs.